The Gary Knoll Show, weekdays at noon, Eastern Daylight Time, on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest in how we can live a longer and healthier life. Is a stranger trustworthy? You'll know in 20 seconds. The latest on cell phones from World Health Organization and the Environmental Health Trust. Are they safe? I'll share you the myth and fact. You know those X-ray body scanners used in U.S. airports? Europe is banning them. Why won't we? My guest in the second part of our program, and this will start about 12:30, is Richard Heinberg. He is widely recognized as one of the world's experts on peak oil, and it's repercussions on the world economy and food and transportation, and the need to transition away from fossil fuels and create a more sustainable future. And he will be a part of our conversations with remarkable minds. Passing our global economic turning point, the end of growth, and the new economic reality that is ahead of us. You will not want to miss this. Twitter friends and tell them, very important conversation coming up today, one you are not going to hear elsewhere. That's our program. Let's go to the issues at hand. For those of you who are used to hearing me on some of the other stations, they are fundraising. I'm not participating, and I felt that it was way too soon after a major one-month drive to come back 3 weeks later and do another pitch. But they have to raise funds. But we have to continue to share positive information with our audience. And we'll be back there as of Friday. Now, cell phones are just a reality of our life today. The World Health Organization has stated that there's no real good science that cell phones produce any bad habits or bad physical conditions. That's the statement, and that's carried by the mainstream media, but that's a myth. Here are the facts. 31 highly acclaimed members of the International Agency of Research on Cancer, a World Health Organization committee, voted in a nearly unanimous decision after detailed examination of the data. In their expert opinion, cell phone radiation, also known as microwave radiation, is in the same rank as many things you would never let your child play with, including jet and diesel fuel and some chlorinated pesticides like DDT and Kepone. The World Health Organization determined that, quote, radio frequency radiation and electromagnetic fields warranted a 2B classification as a possible carcinogen based upon an exhaustive examination of peer-reviewed published epidemiological studies. They concluded that human studies consistently found that with more than 10 years of use, with 30 minutes a day considered a high use, there is a significantly increased risk of gliomas, a lethal brain tumor. The World Health Organization explicitly rejected the recent negative and widely publicized study from Denmark on brain cancer and cell phones in the British Medical Journal because it lacked detailed information on phone use and the power to find any change of risk. Myth. There is no biological mechanism for cell phone radiation to cause cancer. That's what the industry says. Fact. This statement implies that science understands the underlying mechanisms through which cancer arises in all instances. In the history of science, it often takes decades before a mechanism is understood. We do not fully understand the biological mechanisms through which tobacco causes lung cancer. The experimental and human data reviewed by the World Health Organization were substantial enough to bring them to an almost unanimous decision regarding this classification of cell phone radiation as a possible cause of cancer. Myth. If cell phones were really causing brain tumors, with so many people using them, we should be seeing an increase in brain tumor incidence, and we're not. Fact, many doctors report that they are seeing an increase in brain tumors in younger people in their own practices, and because more than 70% of all brain cancers occur in persons over the age of 60, the overall age-adjusted rate of brain cancer reflects chiefly what has happened in older persons. From other research, we know that the average latency period between exposure and development of a glioma is 20 to 30 years, similar to all solid tumors such as lung cancer. Studies of smokers find no increase in risk just 10 years after most have begun to smoke. But later, yes. And finally, myth. The FDA, the American Cancer Society, and the FCC say that cell phones are safe. Well, fact. As Judge Alsup recently noted in his opinion, the FCC has never said that cell phone radiation poses no danger at all, only that radiation can be set at acceptable levels. Websites in these groups all include information on keeping phones at a safe distance from the body, as do fine print warnings that manufacturers provide. Formerly, the American Cancer Society claimed there was no evidence linking brain tumors to cell phones. Since the World Health Organization classification, the American Cancer Society notes that it's sensible to take precautions with children and states, quote, "The bottom line is the evidence is enough to warrant concern." In fact, the FCC and FDA advise that cell phones are safe only if held a certain distance in the body. The FCC requires a safety distance data to be in every manual. Currently, this data is being hidden in fine print warnings in user manuals that few read. So, the evidence is in. Cell phones are bad, and there's no more argument on that. Europe is banning the X-ray body scanners. Why aren't we? The European Union this week prohibited the use of X-ray body scanners in European airports, parting ways with U.S. Transportation Security Administration, which has developed hundreds of the scanners as a way to screen millions of airline passengers for explosives hidden under clothing. The European Commission, which enforces common policies in the 27 member countries, adopted the rule, quote, "in order not to risk jeopardizing citizens' health and safety." Well, so in Europe, they're looking at science that says there is a risk. In the United States, we haven't been able to find anything that will support that, so we're told. So never get one of those body scanners. Ask for a pat-down if need be. And even though that's offensive, it's not the radiation getting into your body. Good news for those of you who have had strokes, magnets can help you. Stimulating the brain with magnets is likely to improve the language skills of stroke survivors. This is research conducted at University of Queensland School of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences. They found a marked improvement in the language skills of stroke patients after they underwent transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS. Now, this is a non-invasive method that seeks to target brain activity to facilitate the reorganization of brain regions for the purpose of language behavior. And this is in the European Journal of Neurology. So a lot of people use magnets. There's different types of magnets, different strength of magnets. But now the science is gearing up again, all these good things. Diabetes, how bad is it? A diabetic person dies every 8 seconds. This is the latest research on this. And how much does it cost? Diabetes care costs $465 billion a year. And the World Diabetes Day, which is coming up, in fact, we just passed it. Talked about this, but we're doing nothing in the United States to stop diabetes. Is a stranger trustworthy? You'll know in 20 seconds. Now, this is from Science Daily. I'll quote this. There's definitely something to be said for first impressions. New research from the University of California, Berkeley, suggests it can take just 20 seconds to detect whether a stranger is genetically inclined to be trustworthy, kind, or compassionate. The findings reinforce that healthy humans are wired to recognize strangers who may help them out in tough situations. They also pave the way for genetic therapies for people who are not innately sympathetic. It's remarkable that complete strangers could pick up on who's trustworthy, kind, or compassionate in 20 seconds when all they saw was a person sitting in a chair listening to someone talk. And this is part of that intuition. But here's what they're saying. It's the listeners who got the highest ratings for empathy, it turned out, possessed a particular variation of the oxytocin receptor gene, GG gene type. People can't see genes, so there has to be something going on that is signaling these genetic differences to the strangers. What we found is that the people who had two copies of the G version displayed more trustworthy behavior, more head nods, more eye contact, more smiling, more open body posture. Now, I would add to this that a lot of what we exhibit are survival skills, and also we've adapted from our parents and our caregivers. If we had parents that smiled a lot, laughed a lot, tried to diffuse arguments, it's more likely we will do the same because we're observers and we're sponges for this information. But if we were around people who were too serious, who argued, who blamed, there's a high probability that we will develop that same attitude. So even if we could be trusted, we could be sharing an attitude that says, I have a lot of barriers in front of me. Don't push them down. An attitude is what is always picked up on real quick. Now, tomorrow I'm going to talk about the power of numbers in the war over raw dairy, how the CDC lied about deaths from raw milk and other things when the numbers weren't there, and how National Public Radio picked right up on it and carried the CDC's information without challenging them. We'll get into the whole raw FDA confiscation, USDA confiscation, closing down raw dairies on tomorrow's program. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
There's a home place under fire tonight in the heartland. And the bankers are taking my home and my land from me. There's a big gaping hole in my chest now where my heart was. And a hole in the sky where God used to be. There's a home place under fire tonight in the heartland. It's a well where the water's so bitter nobody can drink. Ain't no way to get high and my mouth is so dry that I can't breathe. Don't they know that I'm dying? Why ain't nobody crying for me? My American dream fell apart at the seams. You tell me what it means. You tell me what it means.
Nice to be with us, everyone. Willie Nelson and Bob Dylan chose that today because of what's going on in the world. Some land in Japan is too radioactive to farm. This is from staff writers at Terra Daily. Quote, farmland in parts of Japan no longer safe because of high levels of radiation in the soil, scientists have warned, as the country struggles to recover from the Fukushima atomic disaster. A team of international researchers said food production would likely be severely impaired by the elevated levels of cesium found in the soil samples across eastern Fukushima in the wake of meltdowns at the tsunami-hit plant. The study was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, two articles saying the same thing. And by the way, it takes hundreds of years for this to get out of the soil. So here is what I'm thinking. This area is where they grow their food. Now imagine a country with densely populated Japan, no longer able to eat food safely, they can only do one of three things. The government can say, well, it's not true, or they can raise the acceptable level of radiation in food into a human body to where it ultimately will cause disease and death, but in the short term, they've kicked it all down the road. Or they can just be honest and say, here's the dilemma we're in, and it's not going to get better, so what can we do about it? Let's see what they do. At least the facts are in. My issue of the day, though I don't know if I'll have time, I'll try to get some calls in on this for issue, is everywhere you look, they're beating the drums that we must invade Iran because they're nukes. For those of us who saw this happen before in Vietnam, in Grenada, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, we should be extremely conscious that there's information that completely refutes the New York Times, the Washington Post, all of the hawks over on Fox Network. This is just one of these. This is Eric Margolis. I'll quote this. It says, the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency long-awaited, much-ballyhooed report on Iran's nuclear activities has been thunderously greeted here as conclusive evidence that Iran is working on nuclear weapons. Both Tehran and a 2007 U.S. Combined Intelligence Assessment deny such claims. There's little new in this report and a lot of deja vu. We read the old story floating around since 2002 about a mysterious laptop stolen from Iran and passed to U.S. intelligence. It allegedly contains the scientific material about explosive comprehension methods to trigger nuclear explosion and designs to shrink nuclear warheads to fit in missile nose cones. The UN and Western powers say this stolen computer's contents conclusively proves Iran has violated the UN's non-proliferation treaty to which Tehran is a signatory. Israel and the United States, partisans as they are raising a hue and cry about an impending nuclear attack on the Jewish state by Iran's crazy leaders. Republicans are baying for war against Iran. The U.S. and the U.N. also claim a Russian scientist who supposedly worked on Iranian nuclear weapons, explosive technology, defected and revealed all to Western intelligence. But now transpires that the scientist actually worked in Russia on explosive technology to produce industrial diamonds, not weapons. Remember Curveball, the key Iraqi defector whose phony claims were the basis for the U.S. invasion of Iraq? Well, welcome Russian scientist Curveball. Last week, Israeli intelligence lost a new missile capable of delivering a nuclear warhead anywhere in Iran and Pakistan. Israel's German-supplied submarines lie off Iran's coast ready to launch nuclear-tipped cruise missiles. Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, again claimed last week that Iran was about to deploy nuclear weapons and threaten war. But Israel's respected former Mossad intelligence chief, Meir Dagan, warned striking Iran would be a, quote, stupid idea. In 1992, Netanyahu claimed Iran would be having nuclear weapons in 3 to 5 years. Shimon Peres, now Israel's president, insisted Iran would have nukes by 1999. In 1995, the New York Times claimed Iran was only 5 years away from nuclear weapons. In 1998, U.S. Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld claimed Iran was fielding a nuclear-armed ICBM and they could hit the United States. And so it is gone, a steady drumbeat of completely false claims. This war of hysteria comes on the heels of U.S. charges of an alleged Iranian plot to kill the Saudi ambassador in Washington, a claim laughed at by many Mideast experts. In fact, it's possible the U.S. FBI mixed up Iranians. The plot's alleged mastermind may not have been a member of Iran's elite military forces at all, but the violently anti-Tehran People's Mujahideen, which Washington still calls a terrorist organization, even though it is now in bed with the pro-Israeli Republican hard right in Israel. So, there are several articles that debunk the IAEA's Soviet nuclear scientist, because he never worked on this computer and all of its information. So what we have is, we end up having another rush to war? Do we have the capacity to see the same people, the same neocons, using the same media and the same type of lies, want us to have another war with Iran? And do you have any idea the consequences to the world, to the price of oil, to what would happen if this were allowed to happen? Your thoughts, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Nall. Let's go into our studio now and say hello to Elizabeth. She reads your mail. I'm on the road. She passes it on. I see if I can address it. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. This is from Paula from St. Louis. She says, I grew up in a home where we didn't question our politics or our beliefs ever. Only in the last 3 years of listening to your program have I realized how many of my beliefs have been simply wrong and the consequences of these beliefs. Today I'm stepping out of the idea that the body politic can solve most of our country's problems. In fact, I don't see how they can, as they're extraordinarily corrupt. I'm from a Clinton Democrat background, and the question is, I'm not sure what the name is for what I'm evolving into, but I would like you to please explain to me what a progressive is, as I'm sure that Glenn Beck and Bill O'Reilly and others have it all wrong. Thank you.
Are you familiar with the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche?
Yes.
Well, he got it right. He said there are no facts, only interpretations. In fact, it was Voltaire who said, doubt is not a pleasant condition, but certainty is. Think of how many times in life we wanted certainty. So with certainty, we did not have the answer we needed. We had the answer we wanted. And so we were able to stay protected. We were able to feel comfort in the certainty of our values and the certainty of our beliefs. But what if doubt would have allowed us to question, and by questioning, we could have changed, and changed for the better? Think of all the things we have today. The certainty that it's better to put your money into a big bank because they're more responsible. Now look at the big banks. Look what they did to us. Yeah. The certainty that if we get someone who's not afraid to go in there and beat up the opposition, that that man is good, but a soft man would not be. So the doubt about who should be a leader caused us to end up with a whole lot of really bad people, from Bill Clinton, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, Bush, and Obama. All bad people, because the certainty that they had the right solutions. You're familiar with George Santayana?
Yes, yeah, Santiago. I know him. Actually, I'm not thoroughly familiar with him.
He said each religion, by the help of more or less myth, which it takes more or less seriously, proposes some method of fortifying the human soul and enabling it to make its peace with its destiny. That said, it was 7 years ago, 7.5 years ago, that I founded the Progressive Radio Network. And the reason I did this is because I just saw that there were too many people whose core values and sense of reasoning did not align with the forms they were using, either in print, radio, or television. You either had to be hard left or hard right, or you were NPR, Wonder Bread for the brain. And I said, this isn't right. I know too many people, myself included, who do not support many of the positions, the politics, the social agendas, the leadership within this particular radio or television venue. But where else could we go? And that's why I formed it.
Yeah.
During the reign of Obama, the campaigner, the term progressivism, first coined in the late 19th century England to denote an independent kind of radicalism that identified with popular causes, became identified with the hopes and dreams of citizens believing his rhetoric of positive change. Now, since then, the term has been muddled. The right ridicules it, the left adopts it, but the real progressives are critical of both the right and the left. And what fundamentally differentiates progressives from the right and left is its basis on creating an ethical society to replace the materialistic and distorted religious ideology of the right and the overly secular, scientifically rationalist rhetoric of the left. We seek a bedrock of ethics, not simply a moral code of rules, that is universal to all and is sensitive and responsive to ecological needs and the needs of the lowest in society. the poorest also should have a place. And when progressives challenge the ruling institutions in the nation and the world, it is based upon an ethos which determines whether that institution is efficient, open, and productive in its mission to serve the most people rather than those who control the power of the institution. That is why I have said over and over again that if we have a bureaucracy that serves no other purpose than to its members working within the bureaucracy, then we should not have it. We should not support it. I believe that we could cut 50% of all jobs out of federal, state, and local governments and make them efficient. We should not have a government that controls the people, that dictates. Then you have whoever's in control deciding what kind of government you want, what kind of rules you want, and that's exactly what has happened. For those in power and those who have power to rule, then we see that they have given themselves a separate set of circumstances and the rest of us have to follow another set. That is wrong. The unions are corrupt in this concept because in order for politicians to get elected, they continue to expand the bureaucracies and favors to those in the bureaucracy. In return, the quid pro quo is, if we're going to give you this pass along 5% or 3% increase per year and give you even more control so it becomes virtually impossible to fire anyone, no matter how incompetent they are, then we expect you to vote for us. And with this wink and a nod, we will campaign for you. And this is corrupt, this is vile, this is perverse, but this is what it's become. And only those who are outside of the system have the courage or at least the decency to see it for what it is. Almost all of our government is corrupt at all levels. If you actually saw, does the money for these contracts, no matter what the contract is, does it actually help someone? The answer is no. Could it be done better? Always. Then why is it doing it this way? Because those in power, through lobbyists, through ALEC, through their unions, through whatever resources they have been able to sit side by side with the policymakers and say, I want this law, we're going to write it for you, I don't want this, we're going to exclude that, and that's how we all live. And yet, what is the quality of our lives? If you try to do something innovative or positive on your own, unless you have official sanction for it, with all your permits and all your bureaucratic oversight that does nothing to help you, then you're limited. So for the progressives, we are sick and tired of the left and the right. The corruption is endemic. I refuse to support anyone in that system, and others are of like mind. And perhaps in American history, we can trace the true progressive spirit to the early Unitarians and Quakers who were tolerant of differences and supported causes that were based on compassion and kindness towards all. In this light, many of the greatest visionaries, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Dorothy Day, Thoreau, Emerson, Thomas Paine, those were all progressives. And also progressives are individuals who can primarily see the long term, the trajectory of where social events and economics and political decisions and science is leading humanity, rather than being blindsided only for change in the short term or sustaining the status quo, which is solely a psychology of selfishness and fear. So when people come to us and say that they have, oh, we know what a progressive is, do you? No. If you are the Obama progressives, then you're looking at all the Frank Lloyd Wrights in architecture, or the historians Charles Beard, and the educational system of John Dewey, or maybe Woodrow Wilson, Teddy Roosevelt, or Henry Crowley, or Charles Merriam. And they differed in the problems. And why? Because the historical political progressives that I have nothing in association with, nothing at all, and that's how they're all labeled. These were the individuals who believed the existing constitutional system was antiquated. It was quaint. They wanted to replace it with the evolving instruments of social change. They believed in pure science and complete deployment of administrative bureaucracy. And so that's what we ended up having. And look at us now, because of this bureaucratic world. We have nothing today but a modern, top-ended, hubris-ridden administrative state. That's all we are. That's all the political parties are. That's all the institutions are. That's all the banking is, the educational system. They are all putridly, administratively corrupt. And once government gets involved in your business, and starts providing you with any services, watch how they dictate to you what you will receive, and you no longer have any control or say-so over them. So yes, I'm opposed to almost all the ways the governments act the people in those positions because they are corrupt and banal. The purpose of government in their mind is its structure. It wants to control all public debate and all public policies. And I'm opposed to that. Our founding fathers were opposed to that. People of true freedom thinking, progressive thinking, are opposed to that. And so that's why we have a difference. Our founders were interested in securing our freedom. Our government today is more interested in master working the bureaucratic institutions of that, and in the process facilitating those who are the most powerful and wealthy to virtually control our oil, our gas, our resources for their use, as if there's no other option except what they tell us. Genetic engineered food instead of organic food. And not only are they opposed to competition, the very antithesis of what they claim, but they don't want to see organic local farmers. They don't want to see you having a vitamin and a health care practitioner instead of a fat, lazy ass, you know, stupid dietitian. Oh, are there too many others not like that? Having been a graduate of dietetic school, I can tell you my own personal experience on that. And yet the dietitian has been able to manipulate the system to control. He or she who delivers the information must be sanctioned. So you sanction lunacy, incompetence, stupidity. That's the way you actually help the world? So we no longer question the end results of anything. All we question then is whether or not the person has done a noble job in explaining their intent and the effort that they will take. We never look at the final results of anything. If we did, we would never want any of those people to be directing us again. So results, we don't care about. We're terrified of them. Effort, let's praise it. Put a name behind it. Make a march. Pink March for Breast Cancer. Have you saved a single life? We don't care about that. That's the difference between a progressive. We do care about results. And we care about the dynamic of solutions without having to moniker them coming from any specific ideology. They just come from wherever good ideas come from, a human consciousness that is free enough to look at a problem with a different perspective. Hope that answers that question.
That's great. Well done. Thank you.
Back in a moment with my guest and our guest is a conversation with remarkable minds, Richard Heinberg. I'm Gary Nall. Please stay with us.
Like the beat of the tom-tom when the jungle shadows fall. Like the tick-tick-tock of the stately clock as it stands against the wall. Like the drip, drip, drip of the raindrops when the summer shower is through. So a voice within me keeps repeating, you, you, you. Night and day, you are the one. Only you beneath the moon and under the sun.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. A major issue facing us today is we are living in a dynamic duality. Dynamic in that the people who are directing this have the power. They have the policymaker, the opinion leader, the media presenter, the enablers at the social context level, and the finances to cause a particular side to get the advantage. So on one side, they say the only way forward is more, greater growth. They start looking at China, anywhere from 7 to 11% growth in their debt gross domestic product per year for a long time. Brazil now, South Korea, the BRIC nations, India, and they're saying, whoa, this year the United States is, what, 2.3%, might go to 2.9%? That's not good. At the same time, they say, we want to continue allowing people to have more of everything. And then there's the other side that has virtually no financing, very little support within the media, that says, shouldn't we first ask ourselves, what is our end goal? Do we want to live a longer life, a happier life? Do we want to live in balance with nature or against nature? Do we want to continue manifest destiny? What do we want? and what resources will we need in order to enable us to achieve this? Within this movement, there are those who are suggesting that we better examine the grid we're on and see about lessening our dependence. Locally grown organic foods, not buying things sold purchased overseas, instead union made, or at least living wage made in the United States. Do we need everything we have? Is happiness just found in the extension of consumerism? So you have this debate going on, but the trouble is it's not a debate at the level where policy is implemented. That's where you see the ads that we cannot have any kind of power except coal, oil, natural gas, nuclear for the next 30 years. And they control the debate. We could argue with them, but we don't have all the resources they have, so they convince the public. My guest is here to explore this. As I mentioned earlier in the program, Richard Heimberg is widely regarded as one of the world's leading experts in peak oil, its repercussions on the world economy and food and transportation, and the need to transition away from fossil fuels and create a more sustainable future. He is currently the senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute in Northern California. He was featured in Leonardo DiCaprio's film The 11th Hour and frequently appears to offer us insights on the truth of fossil fuel-based culture and the future of climate change. He is also the author of the book The Party's Over, which has become a standard text for peak oil position. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, it's good to be with you, Gary.
By the way, he also has a new book, The End of Growth. I'm of the belief that we should, at least those of us who are conscious of the future, we should start preparing ourselves now, developing and mastering the tools for stopping our constant more is better mindset. So would you begin by please giving us an analysis of the two opposing camps? There are those who represent the present financial system of Wall Street, the Treasury and government, who argue we are emerging out of a recession and we are returning to the status quo that will promise renewed growth to the future. And then there's the opposing dissident camp, which includes yourself and myself and others who argue that we have already passed the tipping point of economic growth. There will be no recovery. The resources based upon a model of infinite growth are diminishing rapidly and have passed their peak, and we must now face and adapt to this new reality. So please begin by critiquing the recovery of growth model.
Right. Well, since 2008, we've had a bit of a recovery, but we purchased it with trillions in taxpayer-funded bailouts, stimulus packages, and so on. So what we've done is we've tried out one of the two competing economic theories, the Keynesian theory that all we have to do is apply some government borrowing and spending, and that'll shift us back into the growth mode. We're about to try the competing theory, which says that government just stands in the way, and all we have to do is cut government borrowing and spending, and private enterprise will leap in and create more economic growth. But that experiment's already being tried in Greece, and the result there is declining economic activity, increasing unemployment, and so on. I think that's what we have in store in this country over the next few years as we try out the austerity strategy. The real situation is that nothing is going to get us back to the kind of growth that we saw during the 20th century and the early 2000s. And the reason for that is the convergence of what I call the three Ds: debt, depletion, and disaster. We are seeing the convergence of environmental limits to further economic expansion in real time. And we're trying to fight against that with more borrowing and spending, and it's just not going to work.
All right. Historically, what do you see should be the fundamental focus that has created this economic growth model, and what can we learn from the more silent alternative models, such as tribal societies that are far more sustainable, as we try to adopt to a future of an end of economic growth?
Right. Well, economic growth is something that is pretty recent in time. It was really just in the 20th century that we saw economic growth at the scale and pace that that we've come to think of as normal. You know, when we think of economic growth at, say, 5% per year, it sounds pretty innocuous, but what that actually means is that the economy is doubling in size every 14 years. And think about that. After 14 years, the economy is twice its size. After 28 years, it's four times the size, and so on. You know, nothing in nature grows forever. But economists somehow, during the 20th century, adopted the idea that this was normal, that the economy was supposed to grow forever. Most human economies throughout history have been steady state economies. And you mentioned tribal societies. Well, we don't even have to go back that far. Back in the 18th and 19th centuries, we lived in societies that were powered by renewable energy and economies that were effectively the same size from one year to the next. And that didn't cause, you know, financial catastrophe because we hadn't set up our financial system as a giant Ponzi scheme, which is what we've done over the past few decades. So what we need to do is simply go back to living as normal human beings within the bounds of our ecosystems. And we can do that. It's going to require some rearrangement of our economic system, but it's not rocket science. It's just getting back to normal.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. You and many others have researched and spoken about the fact that we have already reached the peak oil threshold. However, what many people may not realize is that we have also reached peak coal, which still makes up for the majority of the energy in the United States. Share with us, please, the rationale behind our having passed peak coal and what will be the repercussions for those countries such as the U.S. and China that depend so heavily upon coal.
Right. Well, the U.S. gets this year, it's getting about 47% of its electricity from coal. And that's down a bit. We're using a bit more natural gas. China is actually using half of the world's coal. The world burns about 7 billion tons of coal per year. China burns about 3.5 billion tons of coal per year, and the U.S. about 1 billion tons. So the scale of coal consumption is pretty extraordinary. Now, we're constantly told that the U.S. is the Saudi Arabia of coal, and we have, you know, 250 years' worth. Actually, there's a history to that. When the U.S. Geological Survey did its first study of U.S. coal back in 1907, they declared that the U.S. had 5,000 years' worth of coal. Well, it did its next survey in the 1970s.
Hello. Did we lose our guest, Richard? Are you there? Oh, he just dropped off. We'll get Richard Heimberg back on. I'm Gary Nall. This is a continuation of our conversations with Remarkable Minds, and we're speaking with Richard today about we're past peak. And for those of us who are concerned, what will happen is there will always be coal, there will always be oil, and there will always be resources that come from that. But who's going to be able to afford that? Flying an airplane, what if your ticket was $2,000 instead of $500? How many of those flights could you take? Richard's back on. I'm sorry for that disconnect, Richard. Please continue.
Yeah, that's okay. Well, my point was simply there have been a number of recent studies by different scientific teams and organizations suggesting that world coal supplies are far more constrained than we had been led to believe. And China is using so much coal and it's importing increasing amounts, that means that we're destined to see higher coal prices in the fairly near future. This is already happening in the Asia-Pacific region, where coal prices are increasing at about 30% per year. So, we're used to thinking of our country, the United States, as the Saudi Arabia of coal, but even in this country, recent U.S. Geological Survey studies of the biggest coal-producing regions, like the Powder River Basin in Wyoming, suggest that the best, the easiest access to coal is mostly already gone. So as time goes on, we're using lower and lower quality coal, and it's going to be more costly to get it out of the ground.
When you look at our governing institutions, both governments and the multilateral institutions such as the UN departments and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and others, and witness how little is being done to prepare for the long-term scenarios of natural resource depletion, including we're way past peak water, with only 1% of the world's water actually being able to be drinkable, we're not doing anything to protect what we have. What do you foresee as being the most viable future scenarios? And I'm referring to scenarios, planning models that help to account for intangibles that can tip a system and expose the hidden crisis ahead.
Right. Well, you know, we're going to have to begin conserving resources as never before. Because we're depleting not only water, oil, natural gas, and coal, but all of the other mineral resources that we depend upon for all of our industrial processes, everything from coal to uranium, titanium, you know, just, it's a long list. Most of those resources are becoming more scarce and expensive. Up until about the year 2000, they were getting cheaper because we were applying more cheap energy to digging deeper and globalizing the process of resource exploration and extraction. But since about the year 2000, as oil has been getting more expensive, that's made just about everything else more expensive. We're depleting topsoil as well, and that's going to imperil our food system as time goes on. So what we have to do is rely increasingly on modes of production and especially agricultural production that preserve our fresh water, preserve our topsoil, preserve minerals, and then recycle our mineral commodities as much as we possibly can and use renewable energy rather than the non-renewable fossil fuels that are depleting so rapidly.
I appreciate that. Thank you. My final question, like almost all visionaries right now, most people see the Occupy movement as much, much larger than just what's happening here in the United States, but more of a cyclic pattern reemerging from the past. So when I was speaking with my producer, Richard, earlier this morning, he was hoping you might have a chance to address the more global uprisings, especially since we originally didn't see it in just the youth. The youth came quickly into it because they had been suppressed in ways that the American youth are not suppressed. If in America, if you want to go out and, you know, say something, meet with people, you can do so. Write something and read something, you can do so. In other countries, you cannot take that for granted. So there's a difference why people are rising up, but we see all over the world this one big cry that people want to get rid of the tyranny, the oppression, the corruption, and want more freedom to grow as human beings and to express themselves. How do you see this going worldwide, not just in the United States?
Right. Well, I regard this as one big global end-of-growth uprising. You know, for decades, people, for example, in the Middle East and North Africa, were willing to put up with authoritarian regimes as long as their basic needs were met. They didn't want to take the risk of going out in the streets and being shot and so on. Well, now that food prices and fuel prices are rising so rapidly, people in these countries who have to pay a very large proportion of their income for food and fuel and are seeing very high rates of unemployment, they suddenly have nothing to lose. And so those authoritarian regimes are being overthrown. Well, it's kind of the same thing in this country. We've been seeing in slow motion over the past two or three decades the normalization of corruption in our government, in Wall Street. Corruption used to be just a few bad actors breaking the rules, but what's happened is our political system has been changed, so the rules have been changed. So what used to be corruption is now perfectly legal and perfectly normal. But as the economic system begins to deteriorate, people who previously were just sort of watching this process unfold and didn't object to it very much, now are finding that they really do object because they have a stake in this. If the economic system in this country does not change, we're going to see higher unemployment. We're going to see declining household net worth. And it's going to look very, very bad, I'm afraid, over the next few years and even the next couple of decades. People understand that there are a few folks at the top of the economic pyramid who are making out like bandits as the rest are suffering. And suddenly that's no longer tolerable. So the Occupy movement, I think, is an absolutely foreseeable, inevitable process of social change. And whether it's messy or in some cases ineffective or misguided over a short period of time, if you take the long view, I think one has to conclude that this is an unstoppable force of history.
I would agree with that. Thank you very much, Richard, for sharing your insights. We really appreciate being on today.
Well, thank you, Gary.
Richard Heinberg, H-E-I-N-B-E-R-G, the author of The Party's Over, among others. I'm Gary Knoll. I'd like to see what you think. We have some time before the end of the program. Please give a call on this topic, on our refusal to acknowledge that we are past a peak in water, oil, coal, and we must start to look at changing our lifestyles. And I'm not talking about in another 20 years. I'm talking about the next year or two, or we're going to have some serious consequences. Give us a call. Your thoughts, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And while you're thinking about how to address this and call in, we have Dr. Roy Spicer on the line. Hi, Roy.
Hello, Gary.
People, we haven't had a special in a while, and I limit the specials, but so no one else on Progressive Radio Network ever has to raise money. And all the money goes 100% to Progressive Radio Network, but I wanted to give them something unique. And I thought today something really unique is two things. One is, in case of any emergency where electricity goes out for any reason, we just had 1,200,000 people living within this audience, within the voice range of this audience, who were without electricity, meaning no water. So a portable water, so no matter what water they have, they can drink it because it could filter it, and a larger container than a small one, the one I use when I travel, so no matter where you're at, you can have some water that is safe to drink. Roy, as you are an independent environmental scientist, rather than talking about this and being self-serving, I want you to tell us what you have found about these two water filtration systems, why they're important, and how they compete with anything else out there.
Well, first, Gary, the importance of having potable water is a major issue, especially in these emergencies. I live in Florida. We've had these emergencies, and when you have a situation where you can't get bottled water, you're stuck. And then if you don't have water, you could die in a few days. So it's a very critical issue. The best way to deal with these emergencies is to have an emergency filter, and not just any filter. You can't use a typical filter because when they shut the power off, or the power is off by an emergency, there's no chlorination of the water, and you could have bacteria growth, parasites in the water, and that could be lethal to a lot of people. So you have to have a filter that can remove these type of bacteria and germs effectively. And there's only one filter that I found that meets these requirements, and this is the ceramic gravity emergency filter. The ceramic filter has been used worldwide. It's been supplied to government agencies, including UNICEF, International Red Cross. They're used worldwide in situations where you have waterborne diseases. So the filters are very efficient to use. They can be set up in a few minutes. They will hold 3 gallons of water. They can make a gallon of water an hour when you put in at least 2 filters, and it will remove all types of bacteria like E. coli. It's been tested in 7 labs against E. coli, cholera, Shigella, Salmonella. These are waterborne diseases that may occur in emergency situations, and these bacteria are removed 99.99%. These tests have been done at international laboratories. The filters are certified by NSF, which is the highest standard in the industry. It meets all international requirements for parasite and bacteria reduction. So these are very compact. The larger unit is for families. You could have 4, 6, 8, 10 people using these filters. It comes with 2 filters in the housing. you can add up to 5 filters total to produce water a lot faster. So all you have to do is just set it up, pour any source water. It could be from a lake, a stream, a swimming pool, your toilet. It will filter water efficiently and make it potable. It'll remove not only bacteria and parasites, but it'll remove chemicals, chlorine, bad taste and odor, rust, dirt, and sediment. So you're guaranteed that the water you drink through these filters will not be full of bacteria and parasites and safe to drink. The travel filter uses the same filter. It has one filter in, and this is a very unique system. It's very portable. It comes with a travel case. It's only 7 inches long. You can put it in your suitcase, and people take these worldwide. You can go to South America with it, Africa, Asia. Any water that you encounter, you can, again, be safe with putting the water through the filters. So that would be the smaller unit. So both the travel filter and the larger gravity emergency filter are the two units that I would recommend having.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Roy Spicer. So you're special today for those of you who care about being prepared. And so if there ever is an emergency, you at least are the ones who have a capacity to survive. You'll have water you can drink, no matter where you're at. I travel with mine everywhere in the world because there are places where I travel where I would not trust drinking water without my water filter. They're special priced today only. Call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, and you'll be asking for the emergency filter. You can ask for that, and it again, there's two sizes. There's a large size, and then there's a smaller little size, but they are the best of the best, and they get rid of up to 99.99% of anything you wouldn't want in your water. And if you never have to use it, good. It's there. It's an insurance. But think of all the people in New Jersey. Think of the people upstate and in Vermont and Connecticut. Three times, because of a freak snowstorm in October, because of a tropical storm, and because of flooding, did not have water to drink. Now that problem is solved. Give a call, and this is our special, very special price. You can get one or both. 877-627-5065. Now, we're coming up to near the end of the program. Mike Fader's program starts next with his new Wednesday program dealing with the Occupy movement, and you won't want to miss that. Mike does some really good insights. And let's just say hello to Occupy Territory Show starting in 2 minutes. Manny from New York, you're our last caller today.
Yeah, hi, Gary. I wonder if you are aware of and what you might think of Peter Joseph and the Zeitgeist Movement and Jacques Fresco and the Venus Project.
I am familiar with both. I have not been able to see in those at this time the kind of material I would need to support them, but that doesn't mean that others don't find benefit to them. It's just I'm very critical of almost all the movements out there right now, and you have
to
be.
It seems like the Venus Project, what Jacques Fresco does, is right up your alley. He's talking about actually creating cities and ecosystems and
I know that. I'm familiar with both. But I believe that the only way we're going to get to a better world is by building our own personal lives in a better way first, going off the grid personally, emotionally, spiritually, intellectually, and creatively as individuals. Then, and small groups or ourselves or family to create that sustainable life, then build it piece by piece. I do not see some utopian dream of projecting into some major metropolitan cities or major new cities all based upon some futuristic concept. I don't believe it's pragmatic or practical, but I appreciate you sharing that with us. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to say goodbye now. I thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day.
The way you wear your hat. Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tabenfeld.
No, they can't take that away.